Welcome once again to the Counter Vortex with your ranter, Bill Weinberg. Ranting at you in the wee hours of April 11th, 2024, as always from my apartment on Manhattan's Lower East Side, which fortunately is not under aerial bombardment, unlike Gaza, among several other places around the world. And happy as I am that it is now springtime, I do feel an oppressive sense of the passage of time with the change of season this year, partly because I didn't get nearly as much done over the winter as I'd wanted to, and I'm also remembering my spring ritual of many years from back when I used to do radio. I mean, radio, back when I for 20 years produced the late night freeform anarchist variety hour, so to speak, on non-commercial, listener-supported WBAI radio here in New York City. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade was the name of the program, for reasons a bit too obscure to get into at the moment. And the spring ritual, which I did on the program, was a reading of the George Orwell essay, Some Thoughts on the Common Toad, a celebration of the coming of spring, which brilliantly predicted ecological politics back when it was published way back in April of 1946. And I've really been having a hankering to revisit it on the Counter Vortex podcast, as I did once, I think two springs ago. And one of the reasons that I've been reluctant really brings home my nostalgia for radio. On radio, it was live, and before online archiving, once the broadcast went out, it was gone forever. Each listen, each broadcast was a unique experience, never to be repeated. And there's a certain magic to that. Invisible airwaves crackling with life and all that. But as my listeners from back in the day will recall, WBAI started going in a very reactionary direction, aggressively pitching quack cures and ugly right-wing conspiracy theory, and I decided that I wanted to bite the hand that feeds me. I wanted to bite that hand so badly. I wanted to make them wish they'd never seen me. And I did. I called out their ugliness and wackiness and stupidity over the air on their own damn station, and I got sacked for it, or as I prefer to say, purged. This was written up in the New York Times on May 26, 2011, at On Air Haven for Dissent, A Dissenting Voice is Silenced, by reporter Colin Moynihan. You can Google it up and read it. So now I'm producing a damn podcast, like everyone else and his uncle, and one of the ways in which it feels like it lacks the old radio magic is that it isn't live, and people can basically listen whenever they want because it's on the internet. So just because I release this very seasonally appropriate episode on April 11th doesn't mean that's when people are going to listen to it. Nonetheless, I am going to indulge myself here and read aloud George Orwell's Thoughts on the Common Toad. And I will note that my old co-producer of many years on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, Anne Marie Hendrickson, is also continuing to do so each spring on her own show on WBAI today, entitled Mansion for a Rat. We can still be heard every Tuesday night at midnight, which was the old Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade time slot on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Anne Marie was politic enough not to bite the hand that fed her, unlike me, so she is still on WBAI. Although the old Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade was canceled, they later brought her back with her own show. So check it out. She continues to do very interesting work, even if I am thoroughly disillusioned with BAI as an institution. A few things to say about this essay before I dive into it. As I say, it kind of predicts the ecological consciousness that would emerge in the 1970s, and particularly the ideas of thinkers such as Murray Bookchin, the granddaddy of eco-anarchism, and his theory of social ecology, the notion that the ecological crisis cannot be meaningfully addressed without recognizing and addressing its social roots, and also that any movement for social justice is incomplete without an ecological sensitivity. There is an ecological contradiction as well as a class contradiction to capitalism, both fundamental to the capitalist system. The fact that the daily functioning of the system is destroying the biosphere. An ecological sensitivity and class analysis are both needed, and neither is complete without the other. Orwell actually fell just short of making this vital connection. In this essay, he writes, for instance, that the enjoyment of nature does not have what the editors of left-wing newspapers call a class angle. And today, we know that, in fact, it does. The concept of environmental justice has even been taken up by the policymakers today, although this means it's co-optation to a certain extent. For instance, it is in the news at the moment in the controversies around the so-called congestion pricing plan about to be instated here in New York City, despite legal challenges, where they are going to start charging motorists to enter Manhattan with some of the money to go to investing in parks and natural areas in designated environmental justice communities, quote unquote. Now, the idea is to cut down on cars entering Manhattan, a goal that I very much share. But the anarchist in me can't help but take a rather critical view of the idea. You can talk about environmental justice all you want, but this plan is still routing the toxin-spewing death machines into the outer boroughs and New Jersey in order to spare hyper-gentrified Manhattan below 60th Street, Natch. The whole enterprise is an exercise in environmental racism and classism. It places disproportionate burden on the working class. It could hurt small businesses that depend on daily deliveries of produce and other merchandise, and accelerate the transformation of my island into a gentrified Manhattan land. And certainly, it is a techno-fix solution that falls far short of what even the UN Environment Program calls for, in their own words, from an October 2022 report. I quote, "We had our chance to make incremental changes, but that time is over. Only a root and branch transformation of our economies and societies can save us from accelerating climate disaster, end quote. Now, I also recognize that a lot of the backlash to congestion pricing is coming from reactionary motorheads, and I feel very, very uncomfortable being on the same side as them. And the pragmatist in me kind of feels like maybe we should just take what we can get and, you know, have a barrier to cars entering Manhattan. I feel torn about the whole question. I really do. And I certainly don't pretend to have any easy answers as to how to bring about this root and branch transformation. But I do note the small but hopefully meaningful ways that ideas such as those of Murray Bookchin can inform self-organized action at the local and municipal levels as world leaders dither, proffer bogus techno-fix solutions like carbon trading, or consciously obstruct progress in the case of the most aggressively reactionary among the ruling elites or would-be ruling elites like Donald Trump, whose plan 2025, as it is being called, would gut environmental regulations and essentially dismantle the EPA. Google that one up if you're not aware of it. Very frightening stuff. So the kind of small but hopefully meaningful actions I have in mind are those that I discuss every weekend on my radical history walking tour of the Lower East Side that I do for the Museum of Reclaimed Urban Space every Saturday and Sunday at 3 p.m., leaving from the museum, which is in C-Squat, an old squatter building at 155 Avenue C between 9th and 10th Streets. For instance, the city's recycling program and its compost program, which means less methane gas going into the atmosphere, as I explain on the tour. The community gardens, which have now been legalized by the city government, but began as guerrilla actions, so to speak. These all began as self-organized neighborhood initiatives, and it was only generations later that the city bureaucracy followed in the footsteps of the grassroots neighborhood activists and institutionalized these initiatives. I'm going to briefly talk about one before I read the essay because it touches on a crawly aquatic animal, not a toad. I've never actually seen a toad in New York City, but a turtle. One of the community gardens I visit on my tour is La Plaza Cultural, the cultural plaza at 9th Street and Avenue C, which was started by neighborhood Puerto Rican folk back in 1976 on a vacant lot left by the collapse or arson of tenement buildings in the urban blight of that era. So they've been producing soil on that site, the gardeners have, in La Plaza Cultural, through composting ever since the mid-1970s, and they're still doing it today, creating soil and growing vegetables, growing food, right in the concrete jungle of Lower Manhattan. And that garden also has a pond, which has got lily pads and goldfish, koi, and also had for many years a turtle. Now, the turtle was a red-eared slider, which is not actually native to this bioregion. Its native range is in the south, so it was introduced. But it lived in the pond for many years. It lived in the pond year-round. In the winter, it would burrow down into the mud at the bottom of the pond and hibernate. And then for much of the winter, the pond would be frozen over, and you wouldn't see the turtle all winter long. Then, in the spring, the pond would thaw out, and the turtle would come up and say hello and be as good as new. I saw it happen year after year, blew my mind every time. I still cannot quite get my head around the science of it. But interestingly, last spring 2023, the turtle didn't reappear. And I was wondering what happened to the turtle. And it was also last spring that a turtle appeared in the garden directly across Avenue C, or kind of kitty-cornered across Avenue C from La Plaza Catedral, the 9th Street Community Garden, where they've also got a pond, and where a turtle appeared that spring. So I'm wondering, is it the same turtle? Did he, like, escape from La Plaza Catedral and make his slow creeping way across Avenue C and manage not to be hit by a car and establish himself in the pond in the other garden across the avenue? I don't know. In any event, the pond in La Plaza Catedral is really beautiful. It's actually a lot bigger than it was a couple of years ago, because a few years ago there was a big works project undertaken in the garden. And one of the things they did is they made the pond bigger. And they also put in place a drainage system that channels rain runoff into the pond. Now, when rain hits the street, it has nowhere to go except down the sewers. And during a real downpour like Hurricane Sandy, the sewers are past capacity and the neighborhood can be flooded, as it was flooded during Hurricane Sandy in 2012. Whereas when rain hits the garden, it seeps into the soil and it gets retaken up by the plants and the trees. Now, when you have a real downpour like Hurricane Sandy, the soil is saturated faster than the water can be absorbed, and you get runoff, which flows downhill, which is to say toward the street, because the middle of the garden is on higher ground than the edges. Now, with the drainage systems put in place, before the runoff reaches the sidewalk, it gets channeled into a tunnel that flows under the garden and empties out into the pond. A special kind of a tunnel called a hugel bed. That's a concept from European permaculture. The tunnel is filled along the way with semi-permeable substances, dried grass and leaves and whatnot, which slow down the flow of the water. And it's planted along the way with vegetable patches and flower beds and shrubberies, which take up some of the water. And that which does not get taken up empties out into the pond. So the pond and the garden are serving an ecological function in the neighborhood of flood control. And after we had two massive, off-the-charts hurricanes like the city had never witnessed before, Hurricane Irene in 2011 and Hurricane Sandy in 2012, the city government heard about what was happening in La Plaza Catedral with this drainage system that was being put in place, and they said, that's a good idea. And they actually arranged for a grant of $2 million from the New York State Office of Emergency Management to give to the other community gardens in the neighborhood to put in similar drainage systems. So to my mind, this is really a sign of hope. After all of these years and after all of the battles that we had to wage to save community gardens in the Lower East Side and elsewhere around the city from the bulldozers of the developers, finally, the city authorities are beginning to move from viewing the gardens as just in the way of development and wanting to destroy them to make way for development and build on top of them, to actually viewing them as a form of sustainable development and a model for the future. A sign of things finally beginning to tentatively move in the right direction. Progress by officialdom, which is to be applauded, but important to remember, once again, that this was an idea that began as a local neighborhood initiative from the ground up, not from the bureaucracy on down to us commoners. Okay, with that, I am going to read some thoughts on the common toad by George Orwell, which first appeared in the London Tribune on April 12, 1946, and can also be found in the Complete Works of George Orwell, Volume 18. and I will be interjecting a little here and there to explain a few of its outdated references or to update them from London of the 1940s to New York of the 2020s. Forthwith, before The Swallow, before The Daffodil, and not much later than The Snowdrop, The Common Toad salutes the coming of spring after his own fashion, which is to emerge from a hole in the ground where he has lain buried since the previous autumn and crawl as rapidly as possible toward the nearest suitable patch of water. Something, some kind of shudder in the earth, or perhaps merely a rise of a few degrees of the temperature, has told him that it is time to wake up, though a few toads appear to sleep the clock round and miss out a year from time to time. At any rate, I have more than once dug them up, alive and apparently well, in the middle of summer. At this period, after his long fast, the toad has a very spiritual look, like a strict Anglo-Catholic toward the end of Lent. His movements are languid but purposeful. His body is shrunken, and by contrast, his eyes look abnormally large. This allows one to notice, what one might not at another time, that a toad has about the most beautiful eye of any living creature. It is like gold, or more exactly, like the golden-colored semi-precious stone, which one sometimes sees in signet rings, which I think is called a chrysoberyl. For a few days after getting into the water, the toad concentrates on building up his strength by eating small insects. Presently, he is swollen to his normal size again, and then he goes through a phase of intense sexiness. All he knows, at least if he is a male toad, is that he wants to get his arms round something, and if you offer him a stick or even your finger, he will cling to it with surprising strength and take a long time to discover that it is not a female toad. Frequently, one comes upon shapeless masses of 10 or 20 toads rolling over and over in the water, one clinging to another, without distinction of sex. By degrees, however, they sort themselves out into couples, with the male duly sitting on the female's back. You can now distinguish males from females because the male is smaller, darker, and sits on top, with his arms tightly clasped around the female's neck. After a day or two, the spawn is laid in long strings, which wind themselves in and out of the reeds and soon become invisible. A few more weeks, and the water is alive with masses of tiny tadpoles, which rapidly grow larger, sprout hind legs, then forelegs, then shed their tails, and finally, about the middle of the summer, the new generation of toads, smaller than one's thumbnail, but perfect in every particular, crawl out of the water to begin the game anew. I mention the spawning of toads because it is one of the phenomena of spring which most deeply appeal to me, and because the toad, unlike the skylark and the primrose, has never had much of a boost from the poets. But I am aware that many people do not like reptiles or amphibians, and I'm not suggesting that in order to enjoy the spring, you have to take an interest in toads. There are also the crocus, the mistle thrush, the cuckoo, the blackthorn, etc. The point is that the pleasures of spring are available to everybody and cost nothing. Even in the most sordid street, the coming of spring will register itself by some sign or another. If only a brighter blue between the chimney pots, or smokestacks, or the vivid green of an elder sprouting on a blitzed site. This was written right after World War II, so meaning sites that were destroyed by German rockets, although there were plenty of such sites on the Lower East Side back in the 1970s due to landlord arson and abandonment. Indeed, it is remarkable how nature goes on existing, unofficially, as it were, in the very heart of London. I have seen a kestrel flying over the Deptford Gas Works, just as I've seen a red-tailed hawk flying over the Avenue C Con Edison plant. And I have heard a first-rate performance by a blackbird in the Euston Road, just as I've heard first-rate performances by robins on Avenue C. There must be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of birds living in the 4-mile radius, basically meaning central London, we could say Lower Manhattan, and it is rather a pleasing thought that none of them pays a half penny of rent. As for spring, not even the narrow and gloomy streets round the Bank of England, or we could say around the New York Stock Exchange, are quite able to exclude it. It comes seeping in everywhere like one of those new poison gases which pass through all filters. The spring is commonly referred to as a miracle, and during the past 5 or 6 years, this worn-out figure of speech has taken on a new lease of life. After the sort of winters we have had to endure recently, the spring does seem miraculous because it has become gradually harder and harder to believe that it is actually going to happen. Every February since 1940, I have found myself thinking that this time winter is going to be permanent. So this was obviously written before global warming. Winters have been getting milder here in New York City for the past generation and change. But Persephone, like the toads, always rises from the dead at about the same moment. Suddenly, toward the end of March, the miracle happens, and the decaying slum in which I live is transfigured. I will interject that post-gentrification, my neighborhood, the Lower East Side, is no longer a decaying slum, but I, in many ways, miss the days when it was, when I first moved in here, way back in the 1980s. Down the square, the sooty privets have turned a bright green. Or in New York, it would be the forsythia, which actually turn a bright yellow as they flower before they turn a bright green. They're just starting to turn yellow now. The leaves are thickening on the chestnut trees. The daffodils are out. The wallflowers are budding. The policeman's tunic looks a positively pleasant shade of blue. The fishmonger greets his customers with a smile. There really aren't any fishmongers left in my neighborhood. There's still a few down in Chinatown. And even the sparrows are quite a different color, having felt the balminess of the air and nerved themselves to take a bath, their first since last September. Is it wicked to take a pleasure in spring and other seasonal changes? To put it more precisely, is it politically reprehensible when we are all groaning, or at any rate ought to be groaning, under the shackles of the capitalist system, to point out that life is frequently more worth living because of a blackbird's song, a yellow elm tree in October, or some other natural phenomenon which does not cost money and does not have what the editors of left-wing newspapers call a class angle. There is no doubt that many people think so. I know by experience that a favorable reference to nature in one of my articles is liable to bring me abusive letters. And though the key word in these letters is usually sentimental, two ideas seem to be mixed up in them. One is that any pleasure in the actual process of life encourages a sort of political quietism. People, so the thought runs, ought to be discontented, and it is our job to multiply our wants and not simply to increase our enjoyment of the things we have already. The other idea is that this is the age of machines, and that to dislike the machine, or even want to limit its domination, is backward-looking, reactionary, and slightly ridiculous. This is often backed up by the statement that a love of nature is a foible of urbanized people who have no notion of what nature is really like. Those who really have to deal with the soil, so it is argued, do not love the soil and do not take the faintest interest in birds or flowers, except from a strictly utilitarian point of view. To love the country, one must live in the town, merely taking an occasional weekend ramble at the warmer times of year. This last idea is demonstrably false. Medieval literature, for instance, including the popular ballads, is full of an almost Georgian enthusiasm for nature. Okay, this is a reference to Georgian poetry, that popular in Britain during the reign of King George V. This was immediately after the Victorian era and the Industrial Revolution, and there was kind of a backlash in which romanticization of nature was very popular among the poets. So, okay, that explains that. And the art of agricultural peoples, such as the Chinese and Japanese, this was back when the Chinese and Japanese were still agricultural peoples, center always round trees, birds, flowers, rivers, mountains. The other idea seems to me to be wrong in a subtler way. Certainly, we ought to be discontented. We ought not simply to find out ways of making the best of a bad job. And yet, if we kill all pleasure in the actual process of life, what sort of future are we preparing for ourselves? If a man cannot enjoy the return of spring, why should he be happy in a labor-saving utopia? What will he do with the leisure that the machine will give him? Okay, here I have to interject that his faith in the possibilities of a labor-saving utopia look extremely naive from my point of view today, where automation means unemployment rather than leisure for much of the industrial working class. And now artificial intelligence, as it is called, is even threatening the employment of writers and creative types such as myself. To continue with the text, I have always suspected that if our economic and political problems are ever really solved, life will become simpler instead of more complex, and that the sort of pleasure one gets from finding the first primrose will loom larger than the sort of pleasure one gets from eating an ice to the tune of a Wurlitzer. A Wurlitzer, if you recall, were those big organs that were used at amusement parks and ball games. So today we could say drinking a bubble tea to the iTunes on your smartphone. I think that by retaining one's childhood love of such things as trees, fishes, butterflies, and, to return to my first instance, toads, one makes a peaceful and decent future a little more probable, and that by preaching the doctrine that nothing is to be admired except steel and concrete, one merely makes it a little surer that human beings will have no outlet for their surplus energy except in hatred and leader worship. At any rate, spring is here, even in London, N1, or we could say Manhattan, 1-800-930-1009, and they can't stop you enjoying it. This is a satisfying reflection. How many a time have I stood watching the toads mating, or a pair of hares having a boxing match in the young corn, and thought of all the important persons who would stop me enjoying this if they could. But luckily, they can't. So long as you are not actually ill, hungry, frightened, or immured in a prison or a holiday camp, meaning an old folks' home, spring is still spring. The atom bombs are piling up in the factories. The police are prowling the cities. The lies are streaming from the loudspeakers or from the social media apps on your smartphone. But the earth is still going round the sun, and neither the dictators nor the bureaucrats, deeply as they disapprove of the process, are able to prevent it. All right, thank you, George Orwell. Important words, more important today than they were in 1946, I would argue. Because even with the advances in ecological consciousness in the intervening years, the factors that drive the need for ecological consciousness have also advanced. Think about all the natural areas that have been lost, the countless species that have been driven to extinction, and all the carbon and methane that has been spewed into the atmosphere since 1946. And meanwhile, amid the happy daily destruction wrought by the normal functioning of the capitalist system, the horror continues in Gaza, in Ukraine, in Burma, in the Sahel and the Congo, and many other places around the world. We'll be getting back to that next week. Come on out for my tour if the weather is good this weekend. Saturday and Sunday, 3 p.m., leaving from the Museum of Reclaimed Urban Space, 155 Avenue C on the Lower East Side. It costs a little more than you would pay for a movie in Manhattan these days, but so much more worthwhile. All right, hope to see some of you there. In any event, this has been Bill Weinberg with the Counter Vortex. You can check us out online at countervortex.org. Please support us on Patreon, patreon.com/countervortex. Join the Counter Vortex, join the resistance, and rant on you next time.